You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2014 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother Adam Burns on the subject, Learning to Lean. This class is titled, Wrestling.
Well, good morning, all. All y'all. So, have we got a favorite verse in the Bible? Yes, or a favorite few verses. So mine's Isaiah 57, about the high and holy one who inhabits eternity, and yet he's also happy to dwell with the contrite, to revive the hearts of the lowly and the contrite. He's got this lovely idea about God who inhabits eternity and yet chooses to live in us. That's an amazing idea. But do you have a favorite chapter? Less so, maybe. But this today is, we're going to look at my favourite chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 32. So we might, we're just going to spend our time just in this chapter. It's a remarkable chapter. It's got, for me, it's got it all. It's kind of got a beautiful writing style. There's this incredible poetry in the way that the chapter's balanced out and presented. There's incredible drama within the story. And I think there's a really clever way of... I'll stay still. Thanks, Jim. A really clever way of relating this story. And this chapter is a significant turning point. I've been through the airport. This is what I do. Yeah. And to Texas. I've been to Texas. No. So this chapter is a significant turning point for Jacob, much like I believe Bethel was 40 years earlier. And after this day and this night, some things will never be the same again for Jacob. Now, we've learned something important already about Jacob, and that is, as a whole, his life charts very much like my life, ups and downs. And so you've got, you know, in the birthright, okay, we got to see, I guess, his values. He valued things, but in many senses, it was a down. Maybe you'd say the same with the blessing. You've got it sort of spikes back up in terms of the angels visiting him in Bethel. 40 years, kind of this sort of flat spot. So you've got ups and downs and flat spots and sticks and strips, and then leaving Laban's a good thing and so on. And so you've got this kind of gritty tale when it comes to Jacob of ups and downs, and there's comfort here for me that even though there have been great spiritual moments in my life and your lives too, I'm sure there are times where I slump, where I fail, and where I disappoint. And that doesn't diminish and it doesn't void the importance or the relevance of our spiritual highs. In fact, it makes their existence absolutely fundamentally important, more vital than ever before. The slumps make the highs important. Our lives reflect Jacob's path, ups, downs, and flat spots. It would be unrealistic to think that our spiritual life should be an exponential curve, you know, off into infinity. It's an unrealistic expectation to have of ourselves, for we are Jacob and Jacob is us. And so we've seen this particular characteristic of this seesawing, and I think it's going to start emerging more. We're sort of seeing so far a seesawing more in the negative, and every now and then he tips over to the positive, but we start to see in his life from this point on more of a seesaw back towards positive in his life. And Genesis 32, in some ways, is this perfect summation of Jacob's life. If there's one chapter that takes an entire life and compresses it into just that chapter, in symbol and in words, then this is it. And there's two incidents recorded here, but there's really only one theme, two perspectives of the one issue. So he takes his journey in the day, that's sort of scene one, and scene two is the wrestle at night. So two scenes, one story, and it's really exciting writing, I think. It starts with this literal narration of Jacob's journey, so literally his journey, and then a parable of his journey in the night. So I want to walk through these two scenes and note together the single theme. So we're just going to stick in Genesis 32 this morning. And so we pick up the story with him leaving Laban, as we remember yesterday, and faithfully responds to the call of the angel and heads home towards Israel. And he waves off behind him as Laban disappears into the distance over the horizon to the east. He waves off that 40 years of misery and deceit and being ripped off in his wages and tricked in his marriage and so on, and turns and heads back to the land. And as soon as he does that, we see that God is loving, God is involved, God is present, God's still with him, just as he had promised at Bethel, and God shows him the angels. He literally shows him that the angels are travelling with him. Let's just read verses 1 and 2. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two camps. That's right. What I'd like you to try and enter into here and try to see here is actually a wrestle now between God and Jacob at play. I think this is fundamentally important to understand this chapter and also to understand Jacob's life. The wrestling actually doesn't start in verse 24 of this chapter. It starts right here and in verse 1. And the first part of the wrestle is God actually being involved and he's pulling Jacob towards him. The wrestle starts with God pulling Jacob towards him and saying, "Look here, Jacob, come close to me. I'm going to show you how close I am to you. Mahanaim, I've got my angels here with you." I mean, this is incredible. I mean, imagine if on our flight home, the nine of us are sitting in row G, and just at row D, a few rows in front of us, is nine angels. Like, it would bring perspective to turbulence, wouldn't it? You'd be kind of pretty cool with turbulence. If there's a row of nine angels, you think, wow, God is looking after us. Or on your drive home, Saturday or Sunday, as you're driving home, you look in the lane next to you and there's an RV full of angels. I mean, would it make a difference to your trip home, do you think? Would it kind of give you a bit more confidence? Would you kind of be like, wow, God is here with me? So that's the first part of the wrestle. But Jacob's mind soon turns to his brother Esau, the one that, of course, 40 years ago he ran away from, and now he's coming back to the land. Okay, that's great. Two camps. There's the angels just over there. As I set up my fire, the angels are setting up their fire. They've got their tents over on that little hill, and we're here. Isn't that great? Ah, but what about Esau? And so his mind quickly turns from the angels of God, and he sent messages ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my master Esau. Your servant Jacob says, 'I've been staying with Laban and have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, men servants and maid servants. Now I'm sending this message to my Lord that I may find favour in your eyes.'" And again, I want you to try and stay close to the wrestle. Jacob sends envoys. He sends men to resolve this kind of outstanding issue, this sort of unfinished business with Esau. And I'd like you to see him being somewhat hands-on. It's Jacob who says, "I know the angels are just camped there, but look, I'm going to go back to my old ways. I'm going to try and sort this kind of issue out with Esau that I may find favour with my brother Esau." And so you think, he's going to come home the same way he left. He's making the same mistake again. He's going to try and do this whole trickery and rely upon himself again. You go, I can't believe it, he's going to do it again. Playing games with Esau, trying to manipulate and coerce and wrestle control to himself. God pulls him close, and it's almost as if Jacob pushes God away. You can see this wrestle at play, and he relies upon himself again. But things don't go according to plan. We're starting to see this as a theme in Jacob's life, because his nightmares are revealed to be true, his worst nightmare. And the messengers return to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps, thinking, if Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, then the camp that is left will escape. And so Esau, oh, couple, 400 men. And what does he do? We can't miss the great theme here in this exchange, in this chapter. Jacob divides into what? What's another word for two camps? Matt, can you believe it? I mean, this is crazy. God's angels are just there on that other little ridge, just in the knoll on the other side of that ridge. There's already two camps, and Jacob's like, oh, I'm not interested in that. And you see a wrestle here, and again he's relying upon his own ingenuity. Only four verses ago, there's two camps already. Jacob's wrestling with God. Who is going to resolve this matter? Will Jacob trust in his second camp or in God's second camp? And he wrestles control to himself, forgets about God's camp, and he's back to his old ways. But Jacob's like me, and I'm sure he's like you, and in times of doubt, and sadly only sometimes in times of doubt, in times of trial, in times of challenge, in times when things are kind of out of control and crazy and you're despairing, are the times where you finally, stupidly, finally return to God. And that's exactly what happens. We see the wrestle returns in a sense back towards God in the next part of the story. And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your country and your kindred that I may do you good. I'm not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps." Bit of irony there. "Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." And you might think, oh, too little, too late, but I don't. I think this is beautiful. "Please deliver me." He does understand that ultimately it is only God who can deliver, and our lives are like this. We wrestle back and forth with God. Jacob wrestles back and forth with God. And when times are dire, we fall on our knees and we ask God for forgiveness. I probably want to be clear about something here. I'm not being idealistic and suggesting that when a problem emerges in our life that we're just passive and sit back and leave it to God. I think there's kind of this healthy balance between self-action and trusting in God. You know, if you get cancer, you seek treatment and you pray. You get a job and you ask God to look after your family, that kind of thing. But I guess in my life, and I assume in yours, that if one part of that balance is going to fail, then it is inevitably the part where you tend to trust in God. At least it is for me. And I think this struggle is dramatically obvious in Jacob's life. So he pours out his heart to God there in verses 9 to 12. He asks God not to forget. He asked God to deliver him. And so again, you're seeing God pulls, Jacob pushes, Jacob starts to set up his own camp, again wrestles God away, then he falls back towards God and says, "Please deliver me, God." And then guess what he does next? That's the same old Jacob. The wrestle happens again in the negative way. He rises from his prayer and he turns back to his own right arm, to his own strength. and he sets in place this elaborate procession of gifts to Esau. Drove of animals after drove of animals. Over 550 animals. And he's very deliberate about it. You can see he packages, it's sort of like the Christmas presents. It's like when you bring out presents for your kids, you sort of bring out one. I think, isn't that lovely? What great. Then you bring out the next one. And it's like, the kids just can't believe it. They just keep coming out. Well, Jacob does the same thing. He packages up 200 female goats. Awesome. Sends them off, gives a bit of a gap. Then there's 20 male goats, packages up, put the bow on it. Sends them off, 200 ewe rams, 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, then 40 cows, then 10 bulls, then 20 female donkeys, then 10 male donkeys. You imagine Esau, it's like, it's Christmas. It's like, there's all this stuff just coming down the road. And I guess, I mean, we appreciate this was an incredibly valuable series of gifts that are going to Esau, no doubt designed to appease the 401 men that were coming charging towards him. And for those of you who think that Jacob's just being prudent here, he's being kind of wise and sensible, then don't really ascribe to my view that he's sort of in this wrestle with God and falling back to his own right arm, then I think Jacob has a confession for us in verse 20 where he says, in verse 20 of chapter 32. And you shall say, moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us, for he thought, I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. And so again, I see this wrestle at play. Jacob wrestles control to himself, sits down, says, God, fix this for me, please. And then he thinks, oh, hang on, I'm going to find a way to kind of appease him. Let's work this guy over again. Let's send off all these presents. And then his final act of wrestling in the day, and that this final act of self-reliance, is when he separates his wives and his children so that they're more safely located on the other side of the stream from the direction in which Esau's coming. So Esau's coming this way and he puts the family over the other side of the stream. He stands between Esau and his family. And the sun sets and God and Jacob had been wrestling all day long. And the wrestling takes a new form now in the second half of this chapter. Let's just read verses 22 to 30 together. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said unto him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. Then he said, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. And so the day previous had seen a wrestle between God and Jacob, and of course a wrestle then ensues physically and literally in the evening. And it's the same story told again. There's kind of this multi-layered way of telling the same story in the chapter. For it's a literal story, of course. There's a literal wrestling here between Jacob and an angel. And yet it's also a parable of Jacob's life itself, a parable of his spiritual life. And I think there's two important points to this wrestle to pick up. The first is, they wrestled all night, and the angel was not prevailing. I mean, can you believe that? Jacob and the angel, if Jacob's not winning, at least there is no winner here. That there is an equal battle between a man and an angel. They wrestled until the breaking of the dawn. And those words, when the angel saw that he did not prevail against Jacob. Now, you look at what the commentators say about this, and they kind of say, well, they restrict their analysis to trying to understand, well, how is it that an angel cannot just quickly beat up a man? And they sort of say, oh, well, it must be that angels sometimes come as men, so it must be that their powers are removed, and so there was this kind of this equal battle. So that's their kind of analysis around this whole idea why the angel couldn't beat Jacob. But they completely missed the point. Jacob wrestled with God all night. Jacob wrestled with God for a long time. He wrestled with the birthright. He wrestled with the blessing. He wrestled at Bethel. He wrestled for 40 years at Laban's. He wrestled all day yesterday with God. He was in this long wrestle with God, and no one was prevailing. Now, I get that. I don't know if you get that, but I get that. God and I have been in a wrestle. I don't know. When do we say our wrestle starts? Is it the age of 12 or 13 when you're kind of starting to get it? Is it when you get baptized? But God and I have been wrestling all night long. Sadly, sometimes he's not prevailing. Sometimes I can almost prevail in this wrestle with God. I mean, God's given us this gift of free will, the power to choose, to decide whether we're going to serve me, serve him, to decide how this wrestle is going to play out. And the choice can be a long, combative wrestle between God and us. And so, in a sense, because of our free will, we can prevail. In a sense, of course, ultimately, God wins. Mortality sorts all that out. But in a sense, in our discipleship, we can wrestle and at times prevail. God was wrestling with Jacob for a long time, and no one, we've seen it, we've witnessed it, no one was prevailing. And the second point, I think, is a remarkable point, and it's this remarkable idea of how God reveals himself to us, to Jacob and to us. It's akin to, I love the way God or Jesus reveals his father in the parable of the prodigal son. The father sees this boy running out, coming back over the hill, dragging his feet. And what does he do? He just sit on his chair waiting for that boy to drag his sorry self back. What does he do? He jumps up off the porch. He jumps over the stairs. He runs down the path. He jumps that front fence like it's 2 inches high, and he runs to his son. I mean, that is a remarkable way for Jesus to reveal his dad to us, yeah? This is his father and the way he feels. You've got a really gritty kind of real expression of relaying of God's character to us. In the very same way, I think this occurs in Genesis 32. We don't have a God here who's distant, who's elevated, or removed. This is a God who is present, he's tactile, he's gritty, he's rolling around in the dirt with Jacob, hand to hand, not momentarily, but all night long. And it's lovely the way God is revealed to us in this parable. And then finally, after much wrestling, God does something vital for Jacob. He just reaches out and he just touches him. And Jacob is shown literally, physically in his own body, and also in parable, just how it is, how it works when it comes to God, what his relationship with God is, and who actually is in control. And this is a defining touch for Jacob. We shouldn't read over this too quickly. The touch is the turning point. with his hip out of joint, Jacob's eyes are now completely opened. God is in complete control. He's kind of starting to see it. We've been wrestling all night long, and I'm equal. I'm going toe-to-toe and equal with this angel, and all it takes is just a little touch, and he realizes that's wrong. God is in complete control. And so he does what he should always have been doing, what you and I should always be doing. What does he do to the angel? He just, can you remember? Does he push the angel away? Does he shake his hand? Say thanks for the wrestle. What does he do? He holds on. He just holds on to that angel. He's stricken. He's just made completely useless with the little touch. And he's just holding on flat out to the angel. He does not want to let go of God. And for the first time in the account of Jacob's life, his hands are acting exactly how they should be. They're just grasping on to the angel. He's finally going against the grain of his own nature. The hands. Don't forget the hands. They're everywhere. They're everywhere in this night story. There's pushing and pulling and tugging, and then a hand of God just touches him, and then he holds on. They're everywhere in this story. And this is a momentous moment because he's learning. When it comes to God, I just got to hold on. And he holds on so much that the angel says, "Hey, would you let me go?" He's holding on that much. And Jacob's reluctant to do so. "I'm not going to let you go. The only way I'm going to let you go is if you bless me. I'm getting this now. I'm holding on, but I will let go if you bless me." And I think this is the second great turning point in Jacob's life. The first was, of course, Bethel, and the second is in at this stream, Jabbok. And so it's no surprise that we saw this little word play around Bethel where God says, "I'm going to return you and shub you." Jacob says, "Well, seeing you're going to shub me." And so Hosea picks up on this word and says, "Okay, Israel, I know your fidelity is an issue. I want you to shub." And then, do you think this is a wordplay? When it comes to this moment, striving with the angel and prevailing and weeping, as again this world, you turn back to God. And when after you've done that, the very next thing you must do, what Jacob learnt when it came next, and that is to hold fast. He's picking up very clearly on these incidents. And so I guess he needs to learn that the way to blessing is not through scheming, but through surrender and trust. And so finally we're starting to see Jacob learning to lean. It's the title of our series this week. He's finally, slowly in his life, learns to relinquish to God. The striving we start to see in the record starts to diminish somewhat from this point on. And more he learns to lean and trust in the Lord, Yahweh of armies. Yahweh is his memorial name. And I don't know about you, but this is the single hardest thing in my life, to just relinquish my life, my future, my self-assurance, my self-belief, my self-determination, and just learn to lean, to just fully trust in God. And so I think Jacob provides me a lesson, Israel provides me a lesson through Hosea, and I think that lesson is aptly summarized in just these simple ideas. Just turn back to him, turn back to God, hold on to him. I'm going to talk tomorrow about how this may have some relevance, but for now, turn back and hold on to God. God must prevail. The wrestles must end. He must gain ascendancy. So chapter 32, I think the poetic imagery is, it's wonderful, I think, in this chapter. I think it's really rich. I mean, it kind of lends itself to a play, doesn't it? You know, scene one, the day, he wrestles in will all day long with God. Curtains close. Scene two, the night, and he wrestles physically, not just will, but physically with God all night. The curtains close as the wrestling ceases, as he realizes his great need to just hold fast. And with that new understanding, the curtains open again and the new dawn breaks. The sun arose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. So the dawn is a beautiful sort of imagery again, as the new dawn, the new mercies, the mercies of God are new every morning. You see a man limping, leaning on a stick with a new understanding. The dark wrestlings are behind him more and more, and a new day begins with him limping and leaning. And so finishing up in 1634, Oliver Cromwell, I don't know if you know much about Oliver Cromwell, the cruel English general that laid waste to many an Irishman, he spoke to his troops and he spoke to my heart when he said, "Boys, put your trust in God, but be sure to keep your powder dry." Have we heard that saying before? And this, I think, is the very essence of our struggle or our wrestle with God. We try, or at least I try, to have it both ways. I trust in God, I say it. I can stand here, I trust in God, I can say it before you guys, but in the main, I often keep my powder dry. I still at times trust, or often trust in my own abilities. And of course, the second half of what Oliver Cromwell says absolutely negates the first half, doesn't it? I mean, to wet your powder would be the way in which you would trust God. Jacob wrestled with God. He had it both ways often, sometimes trusting God, more often trusting himself. But today, in Genesis 32, God intervenes directly in his life and shows him in an intimate, graphic, and personal way just how his life needs to play out. And so to us, our lives can be marked with the complete folly, the complete stupidity of wrestling with God. When you think about that as a concept, like who's going to win, like it's just folly, and yet we still do it. We still have that impulsive foolishness to trust in our own hands. And I think the instruction from Jacob's life is compelling, and Hosea's advice, it's still good. It still holds true for you and I. It's pretty simple, but it really is everything. Return, hold fast, and become like Jacob, and learn to lean on God.